Hey everyone, Jeremy here, and welcome back to the Towards Data Science podcast. Now, today's guest is someone I've been looking forward to having on the podcast for quite a while now. His name is Brian Christian, and he's the author of a number of best-selling books which probe the connection between humanity and computer science and AI in different ways. Now, his most recent book is called The Alignment Problem, and it explores the technical and philosophical questions that come up when humans try to outsource their thinking to machines. Now, Brian's perspective is really unique, and he does a great job of tying together long-term questions about AI's role in the future of humanity to more immediate issues like AI bias and AI ethics. Now, this was one of my favorite episodes to record so far, and I highly recommend picking up his book if you're looking for a great read on the topic. So, with that said, I'll step out of the way and let you enjoy the chat. All right. Well, Brian, thanks so much for joining me for the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really happy to have you. Your book is The Alignment Problem. It's a fascinating exploration of, well, the alignment problem, but it includes as well an exploration of the history of the alignment problem. And I think that's like one aspect that we've not really explored a lot on the podcast. We've talked to a lot of alignment researchers. We've talked to people about, you know, what the current situation looks like. But I think the historical context really helps us zoom out a little bit, and it ties into a lot of philosophical questions too. So I figured that might be a cool place to kick things off with. Do you mind kind of providing a bit of an overview of what you see as the history of the alignment?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start. And certainly it was revelatory to me to do some of the archival research that went into the book and discover some of these really surprising things. So, for example, I was reading, there's a great book of oral histories about some of the founders of neural networks called Talking Nets, which was edited by James Anderson, who was actually my teacher at Brown when I was an undergrad. I took his neural networks course. And one of the interviews is with Jerome Letvin, who was at MIT, and he's kind of an early cyberneticist from the 50s, 60s. And he was Walter Pitt's best friend, so from McCulloch and Pitts, which many people know, you know, just as a bibliographic citation. But he starts to talk about these stories from the early 40s, and he says, oh yeah, well, you know, when Warren McCulloch and Walter Pitts met, Walter was just a homeless teenager living on the streets of Chicago. And Warren basically became his foster father and, in fact, invited both Walter Pitts and Jerome Letvin to move into his basement and to become kind of like these, you know, foster sons. And it was in that context that this collaboration relationship developed and led us to the paper McCulloch and Pitts, 1943, which is really the beginning of neural networks. And so for me, that was just a kind of shocking reminder that behind the, you know, citations are these deeply human stories, and some of them are very touching. So I really think, you know, in some ways the story begins there. I mean, that's where the book begins, is with Walter Pitts at age 15 running away from home. And fast forward to, let's say, the 1950s, you've got the cybernetics movement, Norbert Wiener at MIT, and the beginning of a set of conferences called the Macy Conferences. And I think they're very significant because they brought together not just a lot of the leading people in the cybernetics movement from the technical side. So you had the usual suspects, Norbert Wiener, Warren McCulloch, Walter Pitts, etc. You also had philosophers, you had psychologists, you had anthropologists. So Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead, who were considered, you know, two of the leading anthropologists of the time. Margaret Mead reported that she found the meeting so interesting that she didn't realize until the end of the day that she had chipped her tooth. She was so engrossed. And I think back to the Macy conferences because I think it's important for us now in the 21st century to be aware of the interdisciplinary spirit in which this field was really born. Because it seems to me that somewhere along the way, we lost a little bit of that, and we're now coming back to it. You know, we're now in what feels to me like this profoundly interdisciplinary moment of bringing in social science and policy and ethics and the law and so forth, cognitive science, etc. But it was in some ways that was the spirit in which this all began. So to kind of bring this question around, I think the beginning of what I would call the alignment problem from a historical standpoint is really in this 1960 essay by Norbert Wiener called Some Moral and Technical Consequences of Automation. And he uses this metaphor of the Sorcerer's Apprentice, which, you know, many people will know as the lovable Mickey Mouse cartoon from the 1940s. But it that goes back to a Goethe poem in the 18th century, but it's the same exact story. It's, you know, the Sorcerer's Apprentice enchants this broom, tells it to fill up a cauldron, but he doesn't really specify, you know, when to stop, and almost ends up drowning himself, etc. And Wiener says, you know, stories like this are not merely the realm of fantasy. You know, this is coming for us. And the famous quote is, if we use to achieve our purposes a mechanical agency with whose operation we cannot efficiently interfere once we have set it going, then we had better be quite sure that the purpose we put into the machine is the thing that we truly desire and not merely some colorful imitation of it. And so I think that really nails it in 1960.
It's such a scary thought that capabilities are now getting to the point where, as you say, that's starting to become relevant. It almost seems like a bit of an uphill battle to make that case, to convince people, especially who will argue, you know, we've been through several AI winters. We've seen the technology ebb and flow, and we've seen enthusiasm in the technology and the promise of the technology ebb and flow as people say, AGI is around the corner. We're about to do it, folks. Like, strap yourselves in and so on. And this kind of creates this, at least what I've seen in talking to some people, it seems to create a bit of friction when you try to argue for more attention to AI safety and AI alignment. I wonder, first off, if this is something that you're seeing yet again, like now as we're moving into this new era, like, is this a powerful voice, a powerful bit of pushback? Or do you think that there's something different that's going on this time around? Because it does, at least to me, seem like we're in a bit of a different universe, but I'd love to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that, I mean, anyone even slightly familiar with the history of AI thinks of it in these like extreme roller coaster cycles of, you know, boom and bust. And there's this question of, you know, is this time different? You know, I mean, I think JFK had organized some White House meetings on AI back in the late 60s, you know. There was a line by the University of Washington law professor Ryan Kalo at one of the Future of Life Institute conferences, where he said, as a law scholar, how do I know that this time is different? Because of the magnitude of the policy response. And that line has stuck with me, and I think that's a significant way of thinking about it. I think from my perspective, what feels different to me is a combination of two things. One is that there really is this question of whether we're on the path to AGI or not. I mean, we'll know in a few years if we can just extrapolate what we have now. There are certainly people who think so, right? So OpenAI being maybe the most well-known examples of people who just say, as far as we can see, just throwing more compute at the models that we currently have and scaling them up, we haven't found the asymptote yet. So we'll find out. I mean, I think going by the current doubling rate, I think the biggest neural network models are doubling something like every 3 to 4 months. And
I've heard 10x a year.
I think we're talking the same figures, plus or minus. Yeah. And we are, I'm trying to think, GPT-3 was 0.1% as many parameters as the human brain has synapses. And so we're, you know, three orders of magnitude off, but we're 10xing every year. So do the math, you know, we're going to have something of at least a kind of, you know, facially comparable complexity to a human brain within the next 3 years, which is not a very long time. So,
and I think Google Switch Transformer 2 is a further 10x on top of OpenAI as well. So just more, you know, more to your point, yeah, it does seem like it seems to hold.
Yeah, so I think that's the one thing, you know, is that we've been in this incredible shockwave, really, from, you know, if you want to try to put a pin in it, I would say AlexNet, you know, October of 2012, really launched this. You know, we saw image categorization error rates drop by 90% in 7 years, which, you know, I don't need to tell, I think, your audience a lot of that. But there's a second trend here, which I think is equally significant and maybe less, you know, less studied, less celebrated, which is the penetration of machine learning systems. Some of them really complex, tons of parameters, some of them quite simple, into the institutional decision-making fabric of society. So one of the stories that I tell in the book, going back to your interest in history, is the rise of statistical risk assessment in criminal justice, which begins really in the late 1920s in Chicago, but doesn't take off until the rise of kind of big data, PCs, et cetera, in like 80s, 90s, 2000s. And now in many states, the use of risk assessment systems to do things like pretrial detention is mandated in state law. And so, I mean, that's just one example, but we are seeing, you know, machine learning systems of varying levels of complexity. They're part of how we do medical diagnosis. They're part of how we do hiring. They're obviously behind social media. They're behind the criminal justice system. Of course, self-driving cars are on their way, et cetera, et cetera. There is kind of a, we've crossed the point of no return in some sense, where, you know, the analogy I use in the book is it's as though we're slowly putting the world on autopilot. These systems that are kind of trained by data are replacing not only human judgment, but also explicitly programmed software of the more kind of familiar variety.
And that really starts to flirt too with a lot of sort of themes about self-determination and free will, even, especially when you start to look at the criminal justice system, like to the degree that we're trying to set up Oracle AIs that can predict whether or not a criminal is going to commit an act, we're stripping them of, to some degree, their right to prove the algorithm wrong and chart their own course. Is that sort of, I mean, I'm assuming there's a lot of pushback on that basis as well. Is that one of the big through lines here as we start to see this ramping up in the legal system?
Yeah, I mean, I think very broadly, you know, the stakes are very high in criminal justice, but it's hardly the only example. I mean, there is this real danger that these systems create feedback loops where their predictions alter the future training data that they see, right? This is the classic non-IID thing that is familiar to people in the field. But these sorts of feedback loops really do happen. I mean, and all the way from, you know, detention decisions, right? If you detain someone, if you incarcerate them, then you lose the ability to know if they would have been rehabilitated had you released them, right? So you can create these feedback loops that way. You can create feedback loops where, let's say there's a, you're a, you know, a lender, and there's a certain, you know, demographic group in the population you have less data about. And because you have less data about them, you're less accurate at predicting who's going to repay their loan. And so you make these inaccurate loans. And as that data comes back, you start to think that people in that group are less creditworthy. But that's merely a reflection of your bad model, right?
Yeah.
But you start to see this kind of, you know, self-fulfilling hypothesis. I think about it also in terms of things as mundane as like autocomplete, you know, in iMessage or SMS or WhatsApp or whatever. You have this model of how people speak, and that model determines what predictions you make, but then people start using those predictions. And so suddenly it's hard to tell whether your model is getting better or people are just getting more complacent at it, taking its suggestions. This is actually a real problem for machine translation, where Google Translate, you know, initially, before they kind of got into the more neural network-based models, initially they were just collecting huge corpora of different human translations of texts, and they would say, okay, we can kind of run these things through the meat grinder, so to speak, and you know, notice that this phrase tends to be translated in this way. But as Google Translate started gaining popularity, the web became filled with its own output. And so they had to do a lot of work to make sure that it wasn't just essentially like, you know, eating its own output. So I think this kind of suggests that there are many, many cases like this. And just to make one more that I think, you know, drives the point home. If you think about self-driving cars, you know, there was the Uber that killed the pedestrian in Tempe, Arizona in 2018. And I read the National Transportation Safety Board review of that accident. It's very, very interesting. There are many kind of interlocking things that went wrong. But one of them was, A, there was a training data issue where the training data appears not to have included jaywalkers. So the model just only expects to ever encounter people at intersections. And so when this person is crossing the road in the middle of the road, it's just not prepared for that. Secondly, it, like many image classification systems, has a pretty brittle ontology. You know, the classic, there are N categories. Every image is in exactly one of those N categories. It's never in more than one. It's never not in any of them. And one of the categories was pedestrian, one of them was cyclist, and this particular woman was walking a bicycle across the street. And so the classification system kept flickering back and forth. It's like, okay, I can see her walking. No, there's definitely a bicycle frame. I can see the tire. No, she's clearly on her feet walking. And each time it would change its mind, it would recompute her probable trajectory from scratch. And so it kept essentially forgetting where it thought she was going to be next. So there are many lessons to be drawn from this, but I think to your question about feedback loops, we create these models that have some simplification of reality. They're making certain assumptions that don't always hold, right? It's the classic George Box quote, all models are wrong. But in this case, the model, so to speak, is so powerful that it can enforce the limits of its own understanding, in this case by literally killing people that don't fit into its pre-programmed ontology, that you must belong into one of these two categories or else all bets are off. And so I think that, to me, is what keeps me up at night. You know, this idea that we set these things into motion that make certain assumptions, but then essentially terraform reality to match the assumptions of the model rather than leaving the model open to change.
Yeah, and often, as you say, in mysterious ways. I often think in this respect to an example that Stuart Russell talked about with social media, say Twitter, right? You know, you hop on Twitter, nominally the goal of the algorithm is to show you things that are interesting to you, but of course it has an incentive also to change you, to polarize you, to make you more predictable, so it's easier to show you things that with high probability you'll click on. And then there's this sort of deeper question as well, which is like, well, presumably I do want myself to change from my interaction with Twitter. So there's some amount of change that's desirable. In what direction and what are the incentives that play into that change? That's sort of a deeper question. It speaks to your point about the interdisciplinary nature of this field. Like all of a sudden you're bringing in ethics, you're bringing in moral philosophy. Is this an area? I mean, I guess one question that always comes to my mind is like, is this an area that is tractable by the current mix of people who are working on this problem, or is it just a much bigger problem than we can currently tackle with just technical people, say?
It's a really good question. I certainly don't think it's a purely technical matter. I think these questions really exist at the boundary between disciplines, between computer science, social science, ethics, law. And so you really need actual human teams that can speak across those divides. And that's, I mean, there's something very exciting about seeing that movement come together. And, you know, I certainly try to draw those parallels myself where I can. And, you know, the book traces a lot of these interdisciplinary connections that I think are really relevant. But it makes it a harder problem to solve because, yes, people are bringing different expertise to the table, different, they're speaking different languages in a sense. And yeah, whether we are up to the task broadly speaking is, I think, an open question. You know, I've been encouraged by what I've seen even in the last 5 years. If you think back, I mean, the founding of OpenAI was like December of 2015, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's easy to forget. It's so recent.
Yeah, and so much as, you know, the Center for Human Compatible AI at Berkeley, where I'm affiliated, started around that time, or excuse me, around 2016. You have the FAT ML conference really taking off in 2016. The DeepMind safety team was hired around that same time. A lot has happened in 5 years, and I think there's evidence that I see that we are kind of rising to meet the moment. You know, if you go to NeurIPS in 2016, you know, there's one researcher I interviewed who said, you know, he went to NeurIPS in 2016 and he said he was a safety researcher, and people kind of looked at him askance, you know. But by 2017, first of all, no one batted an eye when you said I work on safety. There was an entire NeurIPS workshop on AI safety. And so I think there's a culture shift happening. Certainly, I notice it as, you know, a researcher and public intellectual. I get invited by healthcare companies, credit card companies, et cetera, that are like, we're trying to get our heads wrapped around some of these questions, and we're trying to build our own teams and put some of this expertise together and, you know, get a grip on the literature and figure out what we need to do. I think a lot of that scrambling is taking place, which is a good thing. At the same time, these are huge problems. And I would go so far as to say, I think the biggest problems that are affecting society, not just polarization through social media, but also climate change, also the rise of inequality. Those are, to my mind, alignment problems that, you know, you can think of capitalism itself has these, you know, operationalized KPIs, these objective functions, whether they are quarterly earnings or GDP per capita or whatever it is. And these things, broadly speaking, correlate with human flourishing until they don't. And I think that's really where we're at. And so this is the challenge in front of the human race right now.
So this is really now getting to the meat of what I was especially excited to talk to you about. I think there are a couple of different routes that we're going to end up taking here. The first one, I want to highlight something that's interesting about the way you've tended to talk about the alignment problem. And that is, a lot of people refer to the alignment problem in the context of existential risk from AI. It's sort of almost implicitly part of the baggage, the connotation of the term alignment. Usually that's what they mean. AI safety sometimes is a little bit broader. What I find interesting about your use of the term is it seems to sort of trace this through line from contemporary issues that even include things like AI bias and AI fairness, all the way through to the more existential considerations. And I'd love to have you explore that spectrum and sort of what you see as what ties those two ends together.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So really the genesis of this book for me came about circa the summer of 2016. We started to see, on the one hand, you know, concrete problems in AI safety. The paper came out. OpenAI was kind of starting to put a safety team together. You also had, you know, the ProPublica article about Compass and, you know, apparent racial disparities in, you know, detention recommendations. And it felt to me that these were connected in a very deep way that was, at the time, I think, not fully appreciated. I think it's a little bit more understood now. And it was interesting talking to people in the research community and saying, it feels to me like this is all one big thing. That was polarizing when I first started the research. And by the time I finished the book, the majority of people agreed. And you started to see more collaborations you know, where you'd have a paper with one person who's nominally an AI fairness researcher and their co-author is nominally a technical AI safety researcher, but, you know, it's they're able to find actual research projects across those lines. I made several decisions in terms of how to actually structure the book. One thing was I wanted to frame the book in the context of actual present day problems rather than thought experiments. In some ways, my controversial claim is I think we're kind of ready to retire the paperclip maximizer thought experiment. Mm. Because for better or worse, we have enough real world examples that we can just use real cases of machine learning going wrong. We don't have to, you know, think them up. And I think I wanted to be able to take readers on a journey where maybe they have some skepticism about this X risk, you know, far off, you know, hypothetical stuff. But if I just kind of gently lead them through stories of actual things that are going wrong, and we kind of gradually move from supervised learning to reinforcement learning, you start thinking about robotics, et cetera, you can just kind of put an ellipsis on the end of that sentence and yep. The person will fill in the blanks. So that was a deliberate kind of pedagogical strategy that I had. I wanted to kind of gradually bring people to their own conclusions rather than come out of the blocks, guns blazing, saying like, we're all gonna die. And if you don't think so, you're wrong. And here's why you're wrong. I thought it was more sort of a osmosis approach was gonna be more successful. I also think, at a technical level, it's beginning to be understood, but I have had this conviction for a long time that, you know, that bias and fairness community and the technical AI safety community really are working on the same things from a technical perspective. You know, people in the sort of AI bias community are asking these questions about, well, you know, if you scrape an image recognition data set from the newspaper, then, you know, the person who's the most represented in your data set is going to be like the U.S. president.
Yeah.
And so do we really want to train, you know, a Joe Biden detector as opposed to a face detector, you know? That is the same thing that, you know, concrete problems in AI safety was flagging mm-hmm. as, you know, the problem of distribution shift. You train an agent in one set of environments, then you deploy it in a different set of environments and it no longer knows what to do. So I think those connections are very real. And, you know, you can think about one of the biggest things in the fairness literature is this idea of, you know, proxy metrics. You know, you want to build a model that predicts crime, but you can't measure crime. You know, the police are only even aware of a small fraction of the crimes that are committed. That sometimes they arrest the wrong person, sometimes they convict the wrong person, and that's all you can measure. And so you're really building an arrest predictor, not a crime predictor. And those are, sadly, in present-day America, very different things. But we sort of elide that difference when we talk about them, and that's very dangerous. This is the same thing that Norbert Wiener was talking about in the 60s of, you know, we had better put into the objective function the thing that we really care about and not merely, you know, the proxy variable, because the correlation between those things is going to break down. So I think a lot of the concerns of the people worried about existential risk really already exist. Mm-hmm. And that's good and bad. It's bad in the sense that we're sort of already, you know, the slow rolling disaster is already happening. On the other hand, you know, it gives us the ability to get our act together, hopefully, while it's still, you know, manageable.
Yeah.
And take some of the things that we've learned going forward, hopefully, right? So that's the question. It's kind of a race condition between our deployment of this technology and our ability to understand how to make it safe.
Well, it really does seem like what's going on, to your point, is we're now I think one of the key things that's changed is as the technology's gotten exponentially better year over year, the kinds of errors these systems are making are much more clearly intelligent kinds of errors. So I think one of the salient examples that comes to mind for me is OpenAI published their paper on, I think it was called Pathological Reward Functions in the Wild. I think that was it. Essentially, the motorboat. So they train this motorboat to play like this race game, and it ends up just like looping around collecting a bunch of bonus points or something in some section of the map that has nothing to do with the broader goal. And like, this is clearly a goal towards which a lot of intelligence has been deployed. Like this is a concrete goal. This is clearly a way to rack up more points and so on. And it really illustrates that like, it's not always stupid mistakes that these systems make. Sometimes they're intelligent. Sometimes they're intelligent enough not to be obvious or detectable to human beings. So as you keep writing out that ellipsis and the sort of the rest of the sentence is pregnant with possibility, we only have to extrapolate some of those curves and we start to see those sorts of errors take on a much more existential form and shape. Is that sort of like, it's out of those kinds of mistakes that you're primarily concerned sort of existential risk might emerge?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think when I think about existential risk, I'm personally much more kind of consciously focused on the sorts of locking in bad civilizational trajectories rather mm-hmm. than actual extermination. There's an essay by Paul Cristiano called What Failure Looks Like, which I think is a great read, and I share a lot of that sentiment. Part of what he sketches out, or maybe I'm interpolating between his vision and my vision, but it's a sort of Kafka-esque world. I think Kafka is an author that's underappreciated by the AI safety community. This idea that people had, you know, in the early 20th century of a bureaucracy that had gone out of control. You know, this world of paper pushers and rules and regulations, and no one really feels like they have any agency. They're just cogs in this big machine. I think that's a pretty high probability bad future, the way that we're going. That what machine learning does is you create the Kafka-esque bureaucracy, but you take out all of the actual people with the ability to stand up and make exceptions to rules or walk out on the job if they feel like it's not, aligned with their values or whatever. And I think there's an important reminder that when we think about the alignment problem from a technical perspective, there is often this kind of thought experiment, you see it in a lot of papers, that's like a human called H wants to do something, so they build a robot called R. Is R going to do what H wants? And I think that's useful for getting some of the technical results that we want, but it is not actually a useful way of thinking about AGI in the real world, because that is like the hobbyist relationship. You know, like someone builds an AGI in their garage and it does something. That's not the relationship that we have to our technology, right? Most software we have is just like licensed. We don't even own our own. I mean, I don't know, legally, do you even own a smartphone anymore? It's like all being done through this kind mm-hmm. of like extremely complicated end user agreement. The OpenAI API, right, is obviously kind of gated by, they can shut off whoever they want. And it's a reminder too that when AGI comes, like the H and R relationship is already predicated on a future in which AGI is like democratized and commoditized. Like to even get to the point where some random person could just be like, oh, I'm going to make an AGI today over the weekend and it'll help me paint the house or something. That suggests that we've sort of already somehow gotten out of the future of what I think is a more probable scenario where there's some kind of huge corporate duopoly, that there's going to be the Verizon versus the AT&T or the Apple versus Android or whatever it's going to be, Visa versus MasterCard. You know, there's going to be like two AGIs and they're going to have this huge moat around them. So at that point, we don't really need to be focused on the H and R relationship per se, so much as the relationship between what H wants and the business model of the company that's licensing the use of R on a completely, like, you know, can be canceled at any time basis. So this is a long way of saying the term alignment was borrowed by Stuart Russell and the computer science community more broadly from the economics literature. You know, if you go back and read economics papers into the 90s and 80s, they were talking about, like, how do you create a value-aligned organization? How do you align the incentives of your subordinates with, you know, their manager? And that's a reminder, I think a sobering reminder, that alignment was always a human problem first. And it'll be a human problem at the end. You know, even if we can solve the technical aspect such that you can build a system aligned with the values of the people that build it, you're left with, you know, it's like it's a turtles all the way down. You still have to align between the people who build it and the end users and the third parties that are still affected, you know, even if they're not actually using it, et cetera. So that's what awaits us after we solve the technical problem.
So I think that's a really fascinating and important part of this discussion that I would argue, I mean, due to the sort of cultural biases of the field, the deeply technical people were the first to worry about this, that, as you say, H to R relationship became really heavily emphasized because it's the one that you can probe with our technical tools. It's technically tractable. And so it gets all the attention. I guess as the internet meme would have it, you know, why not both is also an option, I suppose, where you could say, my understanding from the more technical side is part of the risk comes from the fact that potentially the very training, so it's not necessarily at deployment, at the deployment stage, but even the very training process of an AGI brings with it existential risk in the form of decisions like this OpenAI you know, speed racer boat, where basically this AGI is being trained. At some point, it develops a sense of agency, sort of what's referred to sometimes as embedded agency, and you develop this self-awareness as maybe part of it. I'm sure I'm abusing terminology here in many different ways, but it reaches the stage in some way and then realizes, oh, like there's instrumental value in preventing humans from shutting me down. There's instrumental value in preventing humans from taking resources that I could use and deploy in the direction of my own goals. And that it's from that sort of primordial conflict that emerges this sort of competition and ultimately existential risk when we're in competition with something much smarter than ourselves. Now, this is obviously, this is like one, I guess I'm describing here really the Nick Bostrom argument in superintelligence. What are your thoughts on that argument? And do you see it as a both and, or do you see it as mostly sort of this like organizational flavor of the alignment problem?
So I think, yeah, one way of thinking about it is kind of the hard takeoff scenario, which is what you've kind of outlined, and the soft takeoff scenario, which is, I guess, closer to what I've outlined. I'm, you know, as I've already indicated, I'm a soft takeoff guy. That's what I think is happening. I mean, I think we're on that gradient as we speak. Things are just getting weirder. I certainly think that the hard takeoff, I mean, the stakes are so high that the fact that, you know, like 50-ish people in the world are thinking about the hard takeoff, I've like met most of them personally, like that seems maybe too few. Maybe too few people think about this. I think that's the weird thing, is that you sometimes see people in the press arguing that these issues get too much attention. It may be the case that they get too much press attention. But the idea that, you know, is 50 people working on preventing the hard takeoff from, you know, destroying this human story, is that too many? Are you really arguing with a straight face? That's too many people thinking about this. So that's my feeling, is I don't personally sympathize with that argument very deeply, but I sure think that it's worth taking seriously because of the stakes, right? It's sort of it's the classic like utilitarian thing of you multiply the probability by the impact, and you're like, okay, well, it seems like unlikely, but we should definitely be covering our butts. yeah, from my perspective, I'm more expecting that there's going to be some kind of blurry line between, you know, AI alignment or ML alignment and the sorts of normal incentive dysfunction that we already have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, politicians are optimizing for staying in office, which often involves very short-term oriented thinking, as well as, you know, paying more attention to fundraising than to actual policy. You know, governments are worried about these macroeconomic things, and, you know, even the difference between mean income and median income ends up being like a huge divergence in terms of that's impact on actual people. There was a section of the book that ended up getting cut, but I was very fascinated with the development of the United Nations Human Development Index, and the story of, you know, the economist Amartya Sen saying, you know, are you crazy? You want me to like just find a number that represents like the human development of a country? Like, that it can't be done. Like, that's ludicrous. And the argument that changed his mind was, if you don't pick something, we're just going to use GDP.
Yeah.
And so he's like, okay, fine, let's use GDP plus literacy plus infant mortality plus, you know, like, lifespan, whatever ends up going into it. But I think it's important to be thinking about. I mean, I don't think there's a huge distinction between deep neural networks as optimizers of an objective function and, you know, corporate org charts as optimizers of some objective function. I don't think there's a big difference, and I imagine you would agree with this, but I think the difference is only going to get smaller. So really, it's an incentive design issue. And so to me, the alignment problem is completely completely of a piece with what's already going wrong. Yes.
Well, this is one of the most exciting and the most terrifying things about it, is that the alignment problem, viewed through a certain lens, is the everything problem. And we haven't solved the everything problem yet. I mean, you alluded to one pretty deep challenge with this, which is identifying good metrics and the sort of like Goodhart's law trap, where the moment you define a metric for anything, it ceases to be a good metric of the thing you're trying to achieve, because people find ways to hack it or what have you. And it kind of seems like the mental model I have, I'd be curious for your take on this, see if you agree, but it's almost as if capabilities, you know, suppose that we do what we seem to be doing today, which is identifying either GDP or, depending on the administration, like the stock market, maybe, as like this metric. We're going to really pin our reputations on this one metric. This is the only thing that matters. Judge me based on this. If it goes up, you know, I'm doing a good job. And it's almost as if as our capability to execute against that metric goes up, eventually it starts to become resolved. Apart from sort of the more general notion of human well-being or the stuff we really care about. And this really becomes target fixation or myopia. And the more we keep optimizing, the more dystopic the world starts to become. AI seems to be just a further tool helping us to optimize even harder against a very narrow and specific objective. Like, would you agree with that interpretation? Or
I would completely agree with that interpretation. You know, and this, bringing it back to Norbert Wiener, sort of the godfather of the alignment problem, you know, he has a great line, which is to me sort of the stuff of nightmares, where he says, thus far in human history, the only thing shielding us from our incompetence has been our impotence. That we've always picked bad metrics, but it hasn't mattered because we haven't had the optimization capability to get all the way to maxing out those metrics. You know, it's like we're sort of taking the safety part of that away. You know, for people with an ML background, right, there's this regularization technique called early stopping, where you just don't optimize as hard.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a kind of helpful regularization throughout human history that we just didn't have the ability to control reality to the degree that we could, you know, hit these targets perfectly. And so we haven't needed to pick the targets perfectly. What makes me most hopeful So if I, you know, force myself to put the more optimistic hat on, part of the movement that we're seeing in the technical side of AI safety is how do we get away from specific metrics altogether, these kind of manually right. specified metrics. Underneath the hood, reinforcement learning still needs some objective function. And, you know, maybe we need yet a deeper paradigm shift. That's an open question. But rather than specifying that objective function manually, let's learn it, right? And so you think about inverse reinforcement learning. You know, my favorite example of this, but there are many, is the collaboration between Paul Cristiano at OpenAI and Jan Like at DeepMind to make the Mujoko virtual robot that could backflip, right? And it's like no one knows how to write a good objective function that refers to, you know, specifies a backflip. It's hard to demonstrate it, you know, so there's a lot of, you know, you could do RL through demonstration, behavior cloning, but it's hard to demonstrate a backflip. So we'll just do this thing where we will show people video clips of the robot like wriggling around at random, and we'll say which of these is, you know, epsilon closer to what you want to see. And we'll use that preference to make some inferences about what we think you think a backflip is operationally. Then we'll optimize against that and show you two more comparisons, and we'll sort of iterate as we go. And it works. You know, after about 900 comparisons, which takes about an hour, it's fairly tedious, but on the other hand, 900 bits of input is not a lot. Not
much, yeah.
It can do these beautiful gymnastic backflips and stick the landing. And that, to me, makes me pretty hopeful that, you know, this is a toy example, obviously, and I have no illusions about what it might mean to scale that up, but we have a process for somehow extracting the ineffable gist of this aesthetic thing that we have in our head in actually getting that into the objective function. Part of what I've been really interested in just in the last 12 months, let's say, has been the unexpected interest that tech companies have in inverse reinforcement learning. You know, for example, there was just a collaboration between some of my colleagues at Berkeley and some people at Twitter looking at, okay, can we use something like IRL to back out an operational definition of what makes a good notification or what makes a good timeline? Rather than having, you know, an engineering meeting where we, you know, get together and decide, you know, we're going to privilege likes over retweets or whatever. You know, at some level, you could just do what the backflip paper did and show people two timelines and say, which of these do you want more? Which is better? And then behind the scenes, you can do all these crazy things to try to develop some kind of KPI or some kind of objective function that actually captures that. That's the kind of thing that I think is very interesting, because 20th century capitalism, et cetera, has all been about these explicit KPIs, the kind of the tyranny of these measurable, you know, indices. Maybe the 21st century is going to be about, you know, these implicit metrics that are actually derived from kind of human preference judgments. I'm not saying that's a silver bullet, but maybe we're starting to unwind like the tyranny of the indices a little bit.
Yeah,
and that's exciting.
I totally agree. So there's so much to dive into it in this direction, but the notion of these implicit reward, not reward function, but just like implicit rewards, it sort of reminds me of the debate over in the 70s, you know, what is pornography, and you know, the classic response is like, I don't know, but I know it when I see it, or I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. One of the risks I imagine with, especially when we get into things like Twitter, like this idea of training machines to do as we do, not as we say, which is essentially what we're talking about here. We're talking about, you know, look at how I respond to this, and then derive from that implicitly what I would have told you to do if I could articulate what I wanted. One of the risks I imagine emerging there is we're not always at our best selves in terms of our revealed preferences, like our actual preferences that we act on. For example, I spend much more time on Twitter than the long-term version of me wants. And that's almost its own alignment problem. I mean, these things become so entangled, right? Like, there are many, many me's, and it's not clear which one I should defer to or which one should have the greater right to determine my future course of actions.
Yeah, there's essentially an alignment problem between system one and system two.
Yeah.
And in a funny way, a lot of what we see from, recommender systems, social media, is the turbocharging of the more reflexive system of, I see a thing, I click on it. That gets reinforced behind the scenes, at YouTube or whatever it might be. And there is a weird way in which it is harder for us to impart our longer term reflective preferences into those systems. Maybe with my most optimistic hat on, maybe this is going to be resolvable in the next 5 to 10 years through huge language models, where there will just be like a text field and you can say to YouTube, like, I'm tired of watching Olympic archery. I would really like to learn more about woodworking, please. Or whatever. Don't show me Formula One clips until it's 8 p.m. because I have to work right now. As open-ended as whatever you could type into the thing, somehow that is turned into some kind of preference vector that then modifies your thing. Maybe that's a way to get, System 2 a seat at the table. Mm-hmm. You still have the question of whether it aligns with their profit incentive. So there might be a tension there where, if your system one wants to eat cookies and your system two wants to lose weight, there's an open question of what makes more money for that company, selling you cookies or selling you workout routines. And so it may not be as simple as let's get system two a seat at the table. But I think that's a starting point. I'm very curious to see if that starts to happen.
It's also, I guess there's the converse risk, which is, system one or our limbic system or whatever you want to call it, the short-term version of ourselves, the one that we're most often ashamed of because it tends to get the better of us, at least me. So there's like a tyranny of system one. There's a tyranny of the short-term self. And that's when you basically go on a cocaine binge and you're just like hooked up to a bunch of joy machines and that's it. It seems like there's also a tyranny of system two where it feels almost like the equivalent of, when I started my undergrad, I made a decision to research and study physics. Now, that was effectively me locking in a commitment for the next 5 years of my life. And while I was okay with that, and I remain okay with that, you just lengthen that commitment and say, hey, I'm now committing to the next, with life extension, the next 200 years of my life to doing this. And all of a sudden, it seems tyrannical, but in reverse. It seems like there's almost a middle ground, a dance between the kind of limbic and cortical systems, system one, system two, whatever the nomenclature is, that we want to respect. And it's like its own challenge to figure out what that should look like and its own philosophical debate. So I guess IRL to me seems like an important part of this, because without it, we're locked into this tyranny of like a KPI, which sounds even more terrifying to me than anything else.
Yeah.
But do you see that dance or do you think that there's a way to kind of transcend that?
I think it's a very deep question. And, I've been talking with some of my colleagues, on the research side about how do you do IRL on an agent, which is essentially comprised of these two battling sub-agents.
Cool.
Right.
Wow.
So,
awesome.
If their preferences come on different timescales. So for example, there's some technical things here that are fun to dig into. So for example, if you have a situation where the user is faced with some preferential A versus B choice, and they take a long time to make the choice, you could say, okay, well, they must have been pretty similar because it took them a while to figure out which one they liked better. So we'll kind of downweight that choice because they preferred one, but probably only by epsilon. Or you could say this choice, because they thought so hard about it, reflects their like deep reflective preferences, you know, their whatever reflective equilibrium. And so it's maybe more important than the decisions they made quickly. There are lots of really fun, you know, philosophical slash computational questions here about methodology that I think are significant.
Yeah, and the fact that they're fun to bounce around is, like, at least to me, is it's part of the cause for concern, because, like, they're fun because they're ambiguous, right? They lead to this open-ended conversation. It's like, oh man, like, what's the right answer here? How exciting. And it's I think Sam Harris referred to this, like, the need to do philosophy on a deadline. It, you know, we're headed to a world where we're going to need answers to these questions. And it's really cool that inverse RL is a part of this conversation. I wanted to explore one other sort of analog for the alignment problem that I think you've spoken about before. And I had Evan Hubinger on, actually, it'll be the episode probably right before this one, I think. But anyway, we talked about evolution. Mm-hmm. And I think it ties into what you were talking about in an interesting way with this idea of early stoppage as a regularization technique. So, you know, you train an AI, like, not to the pinnacle of its performance, but partway, stop it before it can myopically focus too much on its objective rather than some general thing that it's trying to achieve. And it sort of seems like that might, this is a half-baked thought, but it sort of seems like that might be part of what makes the alignment problem so hard. What makes humans so ambiguous in terms of our moral priorities. We are, through some lenses, an example of early stoppage. Like, we are not a fully evolved form. We're like kind of this jumble of stuff. The universe threw particles at itself a whole bunch, and here we are. Is that a reasonable thing? I mean, again, half-baked thought.
That's a deep question. So if you go back to the first paper about inverse reinforcement learning, one of the things that I think it's Stuart Russell and Andrew Ng, maybe Daiichi Harada was also on that paper, but one of the things they say in the conclusion of the paper is this is kind of a stopgap. Like, we're talking about what can you infer by the policy of a, like, fully optimized agent at the end of its learning process. And so in a funny way, in the technical literature, people talk about inverse reinforcement learning and inverse optimal control. There's more or less synonymously, there's kind of more of like, what tribe are you in? But I think if you actually scrutinize the language, like, inverse optimal control captures the idea that you are observing the behavior of an optimal agent, versus inverse reinforcement learning is, at least in its name, the idea that you are observing an agent that is learning in the process of optimizing their policy in an environment. And yeah, as I say, the very first paper on IRL flagged this as an open problem and an issue that needs further work. And that was like 20 years ago. So it's still an open question. I mean, people are thinking about it. But this idea of, you know, what can you infer from an agent who is learning? And they're sort of on a trajectory through this error landscape. They haven't gotten anywhere yet. And to your point about evolution, absolutely the case that humans are on some evolutionary trajectory, ourselves. And, you know, many people in the RL community, I'm thinking of Andy Bartow, Satinder Singh, and many others, have explicitly thought about evolution as this reward designer for humans. That there are the things that make humans, contribute to humans' evolutionary fitness, like surviving and having kids and et cetera, being robust to famine. It's all the things that make an organism fit in an environment. But there's a reward design problem where those aren't the things in your head. The things in your head are like, I want to impress my colleague at this meeting. I want some chocolate. I want a new car. I want to have sex with that person. And somehow that jumble of more kind of myopic or more tangible you know, short to medium term goals, ideally makes you into the kind of species, the kind of organisms that, you know, thrive in an environment. But it's hardly a direct relationship. It's in fact a very convoluted relationship between those things. And so, yeah, you can kind of think of this weird double-decker RL problem where evolution needs to find the right incentives such that when we optimize for those things, we do, you know, we secretly end up doing what evolution wants, even though we think we're doing what we want.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to explore it too, because it sort of leads to other questions around do environments implicitly, like, does an environment like the universe imply a reward function? Like, just by virtue of its very existence, if you initiate it randomly and let time run to infinity, will this environment tend to optimize for a consistent kind of structure or a consistent kind of information distribution? It almost seems like the universe contains that like almost not hard coded, but that implicit promise of, you know, you will be rewarded if you end up optimizing for something like this. And I mean, through this lens, you might say it's something like AGI, or like on the assumption that AGI ends up being something like AGI ends up being the final form of the universe. Everything gets optimized in service of whatever this thing is. Then I don't know. I mean, again, this is very hand wavy, but
well, I mean, this is an idea that is sometimes known as the reward hypothesis. The idea goes back to, it has a funny circular origin where Michael Littman from Brown claims that Rich Sutton invented it, and Rich Sutton claims that Michael Littman invented it. So
that seems kind somehow, of appropriate.
Yeah. Somehow it emerged. And the basic idea is, it's this provisional conjecture that everything that we mean when we talk about, you know, what motivates the behavior of organisms, not just humans, can be thought of as the maximization of some scalar reward function. In the words of Rich Sutton, it's a philosophical thing that's almost certainly wrong, but it's so simple that you kind of have to go with it until you can disprove it later. I think this is a really interesting question.
Well, it also, I think I've just connected in my mind then why this feels so related to the idea of early stoppage. And by the way, I find it really helpful and amusing that, like, every time I think I have a new idea, you're like, oh yeah, this is already a thing that's been, it's kind of heartening to hear that. So I'd love to play test this idea with you a little bit. So we have the universe that's, let's say, to use this as you say, probably wrong philosophical conjecture, but the universe implies some reward function. And clearly we've deviated from it. I mean, this is what, you know, you might refer to as a failure of inner alignment through that lens. Like, the universe nominally wants us to propagate our genes or propagate some kind of information structure through time. And yet here we are preoccupied with sex and podcasts and using contraceptives, which makes absolutely no sense through that lens.
Right.
And yet, weirdly, all of our far future projections seem to imply a return to respecting that more basic and fundamental reward function of the universe. Like, you know, to the extent that AGI ends up being our final form, this is a transient. And to the extent that we deviate from respecting that implicit reward function, that's a temporary thing. Like, eventually we kind of return to it as we develop. Again, conjecture on top of conjecture here, but just kind of an idea I figured I'd throw at you to see what you think.
Yeah, I mean, this gets pretty heady pretty quickly. I mean, there is this funny way in which humans are, you know, we're walking examples of what people like Evan are worried about in terms of inner optimizers. You know, that we're supposed to do what the outer optimizer called evolution wants, but actually we can take control and say, you know, actually I want to spend my life composing symphonies, you know, which, you know, just for the, we have this hearing system that was developed for whatever purposes, and that's probably not what it's developed for, but darn it, I really like symphonies and I'm going to make symphonies. I'm going to take a vow of celibacy and, you know, commit myself to advocating for ideas rather than my genetic material. There is an irony there, which is that the very kind of existentialist taking control of your own destiny is at some level, you know, what we're worried about, right? Because we're the reward designers of these machine systems, and this is the nightmare scenario. Yes, and at the same time, I don't necessarily think that we owe evolution any favors per se.
Right.
So yes, there is this very cosmic sense in which, you know, some of the concerns of existential philosophers about what is the meaning of life. We were, you know, we're built to do one thing, but actually you can do whatever you want. So then you're faced with this, you know, vertiginous question of what to make of your life. There is a funny way in which that does come back around to this alignment question.
Yeah, I guess it's, yeah, and I didn't mean to sort of load it normatively and say, you know, we should therefore build an AGI very much, but it raises that question of, you know, where do we place the value? And we do have to sort of be somewhat arbitrary, and not that this is anything new, but in ascribing value to like humans, and for some reason we care about this, so let's, you know, set up a field of alignment that, you know, celebrates the primacy of human life, for example. It's sort of interesting. Thank you for the conversation. It really, this has been more of an exploration, I'll say, than any other conversation I've had so far on the podcast in terms of the breadth of stuff we've covered. And it's so clear that you've spent so much time thinking about this. I really appreciate you sharing your insights.
It's been my pleasure. Yeah. Thank you.